Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. This is Marianne Russo. I want to say hello to my co-hosts, Chuck Wally, Mae Wilkinson. They're over on our Twitter tweet chat under the hashtag TCK if you'd like to interact with some other parents. Tonight, my guest is Dr. Carl Picard. Dr. Picard has written about it all. I mean, strong-willed kids, only children, stepfathers, divorce, self-esteem, drugs, why good kids act cruel. Those are just a few of the topics of his book. And he has written incredible self-help books for adults as well, with topics from abuse to affairs to remarriages. And he's also authored an outstanding children's fictions and adult novels. I mean, his list of books is just incredible. And some of my favorite writings by Dr. Picard are his column in Psychology Today, which any parent that has a teen needs to subscribe to this because it is just incredible. And we're going to go into all of it. We're also going to be going into his much anticipated new release that's coming out in a few months, and that is Boomerang Kids. And we'll be discussing why kids today are having such a hard time making it out on their own and boomeranging back to mom and dad's house. So welcome, Dr. Picard. Thank you for joining us again.
Oh, yeah, Marianne. It's good to be with you.
Oh, it's much easier this time. Last time we had you on our tweet chat, and we just couldn't get all that information
out.
Well, I'm glad to have you on the radio.
Yeah,
you know,
the tweet, I really enjoyed that. That was my first experience with it, and it was very fascinating.
Well, everyone loved you. It was great. You know, when I was starting to think about an outline for tonight, I hardly know where to begin. You, it's so much information. So for lack of time, I will focus on two books. I'm going to focus on The Strong-Willed Child, and later in the interview, we'll go into your upcoming release, Boomerang Kids. And then, as I said, I'm also going to be discussing some of my favorite articles of yours from Surviving Your Child's Adolescence, which really are fantastic. So let's get started. The strong-willed child. Now, I think everybody has a different definition of what the strong-willed child is. How do you define willfulness?
Well, the strong-willed child, for me, is if you contrast that with a non-willful child, the difference is that if a non-willful child gets denied or delayed, they may get impatient and they may act disappointed, but then they let it go and they go on. But a strong-willed child, what happens is they make a kind of what I call a conditional shift. And that has to do with the child essentially saying, if I want it, then I want it a lot. If I want it a lot, then I must have it. If I must have it, and this is a conditional shift, I should get it. And if I don't get it, then that condition is violated. And rather than being disappointed, the strong-willed child gets angry. Because when they, what characterizes strong-willed children is that when they identify a want, what they do is they attach their willfulness to the pursuit of that want and their expectation to the notion that they somehow, some way should get that want satisfied.
Right. Do you see it as a lack of problem-solving skills or lack of being able to tolerate disappointment or frustration? Sometimes I wonder if strong-willed is different than defiant.
The training of a strong-willed child is you train them in two forms. One is that you train them in the delay of gratification, so that the frustration does not, they get used to that frustration. And you train them in the denial of gratification, and that is in fact the disappointment issue. And what they have to learn is that, you know, that in the course of life and moving after what they want, there are going to be frustrations and there are going to be disappointments. The reason that's hard to do with a strong-willed child is that they come at you so strongly that sometimes parents, rather than delay, say, okay, you can have it right now, or rather than deny, the parent says, well, I don't want you to get that upset, so okay, you can have it. And so they back off from that delay and denial training. But maybe the most important thing to remember with a strong-willed child is that you want to respect that spirit, because that's going to be a very, very powerful characteristic as the child grows forward in life. They can identify what they want, and they have the stubbornness to persist and go after what they want, and they will keep after it. And so that one of the good things about a strong-willed child is that they are motivated to pursue what they identify as what they want in life, and that's a good quality. I mean, these are not kids that, you know, that don't know what they want. These are not kids who say, well, if I get frustrated, then I'm just going to back off. You know, these are persistent kids with a strong set of wants, and that strong set of wants is going to continue all their life.
Right, it's almost like the upside. You know, I think when my audience is tired of hearing me say it, but with the negative comes the positive. So, you know, there is an upside to even, strong-willed children. And, you know, I was wondering, you know, do you feel that all children that are defiant or, you know, strong-willed have a neurobiological basis to it? And do parents need to know the difference in order to change the behaviors? Because, you know, I think that parents that have a child with a neurobiological disorder think they're the only ones that are dealing with it. And I think that there are a lot of neurotypical children and children without disorders that are also very strong-willed.
Well, I think I guess one of the ways I think of child raising is that it's like what our job as parents is to essentially teach our kid to understand how they are wired and what is the psychological hand that they have been dealt. And we want to help the child learn that, so that they, with that knowledge, they can learn how to manage themselves effectively, you know, and not in some kind of a self-defeating manner. So if you've got a kid who seems to be, for whatever reason, biologically wired to have, you know, very powerful wants with a very high impulsive need to get those gratified, you know, then our job is, while they're still in our care, is to teach them how to manage that. And part of the way, you know, part of the management is the moderation of that, and part of the management is the channeling of that. For example, a strong-willed child with a highly developed interest, that willfulness is terrific, because they take that willfulness and they take every ounce of energy they have and they pursue that interest and they really develop it in powerful ways. By the same token, you know, we have to teach them how to, you know, moderate it, you know, when in fact, you know, they get into a disagreement with a friend and they can't get their way. And now what happens is if willfulness prevails, they may act in a way or say something that injures the friendship. So then we have to teach them that, well, you know, in relationships, you're going to have to learn how to moderate that willfulness so that you don't start running over people and ending up hurting significant relationships for yourself.
Right, because that will go on into adulthood as well. You know,
a child is just an adult in training. I mean,
right.
I mean, that's what we're, and we are the trainers.
Right. You know, but I often find that, parents and, you know, even more importantly, siblings are sometimes held hostage by a willful child. So how should a parent address that issue? Because, you know, a child that's very defiant can really, rule the house.
Well, I guess the issue of, you know, if the parent thinks that the child is ruling the house, then, in fact, the parent feels like, you know, they are essentially victim to the child. And, sometimes it's hard for parents to hear, but the child cannot rule the house without the parent's permission. And so parents need to, what they've got to do is they have got to take a look, encounter by encounter, and sort out what the kid is doing and what they are doing in response and what they can do differently in response and what they can do differently in anticipation of the next episode so that, in fact, they can start getting the child to learn to live on their terms and not have the parents and everybody else in the house living on the willful child's terms. But what it takes to do that is it takes an enormous investment of energy and attention to get that to happen, because you can't. The kid is just all the willful child's doing is they're just doing what they know to do. You know, they are. You know, it's like growth is just a gathering of power. You know, from dependence to independence, and the job of parents is to help the kid gather power. You know, in appropriate as opposed to non-appropriate ways. It is not appropriate for a kid to gather so much power that the rest of the house essentially, you know, turns the ruling of the house over to the kid. So one of the
right, and I think, you know, sometimes parents need to look at that defiance and that behavior not so much as, you know, the negative behavior that it's being presented as, but really as a child that's really struggling to figure out their world and how to problem solve and how to communicate.
That's a really neat statement because, I mean, that is the response that it's hard to focus on. And that's what is really helpful is if you can make an empathetic response. You can try to, you know, to connect, you know, with what the kid is feeling, what really matters to the kid. And, you know, let the child know, can you tell me why this is important to you? Can you tell me how you are feeling? Can you tell me what is going on? I really want to understand. And come in not in a control fashion, but in a concerned fashion. And a lot of times that empathetic connection will allow the kid to, you know, really make a very powerful shift, which is from the issue of the willfulness to the issue of their own emotional state. And once
right.
they do that, you know, then you get a connection. Then you can start talking this stuff out. And what a lot of the willful behavior that people describe is a kid essentially acting out their feelings rather than talking out their feelings. And if there's one thing you want to be able to do with a willful child is you want to be able to help them learn how to talk out their feelings rather than simply impulsively act them out.
Right, and I think parents, you know, a lot of parents sometimes in that old school thinking that, you know, this is my house, I'm the adult, and it's reiterating for the child and parents.
You don't want to get an isometric encounter with a willful child, because what happens is isometrics is where you push against a firm resistance, and in doing so, you build strength. So what happens is the willful child pushes, and the parent says, "You're not going to prevail on this," and the parent pushes back with all their might, and the parent may, in fact, prevail in that episode, but in consequence of this, that the isometric experience causes the willful child to be even stronger the next time out.
So, right, right.
It's a defeating.
And I think it also is that the child learns to mirror how to problem solve and how to, you know, communicate calmly, because if the parent's calm, the child will be, you know, screaming and yelling and throwing out, you know, you're punished and you're this. It's
right.
really defeats the purpose. So, you know, I'm glad that you, you know, you that out. You know, we do often speak about different approaches to handling conflicts. And, you know, I really hope the parents are listening because he can save themselves a lot of aggravation.
One of the things, if parents will do this, it can make a big, two things that they can do. One is if they can treat, when the child is in opposition to them, if they can learn how to treat that child in the moment of opposition, not as an opponent, but as an informant, that's extremely powerful to do, because at that point what the kid is doing is in one way is telling the parent about themselves, and that's where the empathetic response comes in. That's when the parent stops and says, you know, you're acting upset. Can you please tell me how you're feeling? Can you please tell me what is going on? I really want to understand. And turn that episode, you know, turn that kid not into an opponent, but, you know, treat him as an informant.
Right. I love it.
The other part of it is that when parents, that phrase you used earlier is really important, because that's when it's a very telling one, when parents say the kid is ruling the house. And what they usually mean by that is that they're kind of tiptoeing around a kid who is setting the terms of engagement in the house.
Right, they're walking on eggshells, right.
They're on the reactive.
Right.
And what I try to do is I try to get parents to take the initiative back. And that means that, you know, if the kid, as soon as the kid comes in the front door after school, the first thing parents do is, you know, rather than kind of tiptoe around and see where the kid is and what kind of mood they're in, you know, the parent immediately makes some kind of demand or request of the kid. And what they're doing when they do that is, you know, I need to have this done, or would you do this, or this is what I want to have happen now, is they take the initiative to the kid, and the kid then becomes on the reactive to them. And that's what a lot of, when parents lose control of the house to the kid, it
right.
means taking that initiative back.
Right. Well, I hope parents are listening. I mean, even the parents that have, you know, children with, you know, bipolar disorder and, you know, very severe ADHD, I mean, this really is the technique that all parents should be using. I am sitting here with a folder, because every month I receive your writing on surviving your child's adolescence, and I honestly do print them out and keep them in a folder because I love them.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
They are so good. And, you know, I have to say, I had a hard time. I said, I'll pick three or four, and I just couldn't. I had to pick five. So the first one that I want to discuss is titled Adolescence and Emotion, and I'll quote a little bit from it. Adolescence can be a highly emotionally charged time of life. The loss of childhood is so painful, the developmental challenges are so daunting, the vulnerability from insecurity is so great, the demands of growth are so many, and the experience of growing older is so exciting. That's a mouthful.
Right.
So what happens during this loss?
I mean, I love adolescence. I mean, that's
well, what age are you referring to first? What age are you referring to here?
Well, what I'm referring to is what happened with the separation from childhood generally occurs between the ages of 9 to 13. And what that means is that the child, in one way or another, in words or actions, is essentially saying to parents, I no longer want to be defined and treated as a child anymore. And in the process of that, what happens is they start moving away from the old, secure, familiar, comfortable identity of being a child. And at that point, what happens is they don't realize it until after it started happening. They incur a huge loss. I mean, growing up is giving up, and there's nowhere more powerfully reflected than in the entry into adolescence, because the kid now knows that they cannot go home again. You know, they can only go forward. And on the one hand, they're excited, but on the other hand, they are bereaved at the loss, and they are scared of the challenges ahead. And on both counts, they're much more emotionally intensified than before. And then what happens concurrent with early adolescence for most kids is the onset of puberty. And with that when that happens, what happens is they are all of a sudden, you know, as their body reorganizes for sexual maturity, all these hormones are in play. And now both the hormonal influence of things and the fact that now they are acutely self-conscious about their appearance and how they look and how they're developing, and they're feeling insecure about that. And, you know, that's why it's such a huge emotional transition. And then if you couple that, you know, particularly in middle school, with all the social cruelty that happens, and that's with the teasing and the exclusion and the the bullying and the rumoring and the ganging up that kids do, all in service of trying to establish a secure social place when they are feeling developmentally insecure. I mean, You know, it's I had a teacher one time told me, and I've always loved that statement. He said, you know, what we need to do is that we need to declare a moratorium on middle school.
Oh, it's a horror.
I thought that was a great statement.
I love it.
Because these kids are just, there's so much going on in them, and so much of what is going on is emotional.
Absolutely. You know, I tell my kids all the time, if you can make it through middle school, you can make it through anything.
Right. You've graduated into life, right?
Yeah, it's so difficult. And, you know, I maybe because I have girls, I just think it's so hard on the girls. You know, it's
that's another set of issues. But the
whole show in itself.
Has the most difficult sexual passage.
Right.
Because of issues about having a harder time staying connected with her father and a harder time disconnecting from her mom. And there's a lot of intensity and conflict that arises as a vehicle for getting that to happen. So daughters have the harder passage, I think, in general.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, and I think it's important that parents understand that, because, you know, maybe then they can understand, you know, the moodiness, the behaviors, the you know, the roller coaster of emotions, if they understand that, you know, the child really is trying to gain some independence in a very scary and foreign world, which is middle school.
I couldn't
survive middle school now.
Yeah. I mean, and also the kid is not doing emotion to get the parents.
They're suffering. They're struggling.
Yeah, it's just in struggle, and again, that's again why you want to, you know, you want to treat this kid as an informant, not an opponent. You want to make an empathetic response, and you want to, you know, you want to help the kid talk out what's going on, as opposed to either not talk about it at all or act it out.
Right, and you know that brings us to my next article that I chose, which is Vanity Parenting and Adolescent Performance.
Yeah,
I knew you would like that. So what is, don't you, I mean, I think it's a good lead-in. What is vanity parenting, and why is it bad for our kids?
Well,
and I think
vanity,
to some degree, we're all guilty of this.
Yeah, we're absolutely, that's the place to start. We're all guilty of it. We are a performance culture. And, you know, so the notion of, you know, achievement and doing well is something that we feel, you know, is important for us, and we feel it's important for our child. But the parent with vanity parenting kicks in when parents start subscribing to a very dangerous equation, which is parent equals child. And when you do that, the notion is that depending upon how the child does, that's a measure of the parent's performance. And so if the child does well, then the parent feels like it's good parenting, and if the child does badly, the parent feels like it's bad parenting. And what they don't understand, you know, what they don't understand is that they need to break that equation to the degree they can say, you know, good kids, you know, parents who have good kids make bad choices in the normal trial and error process of growing up, and a bad choice does not make a bad child or a bad parent. Well, the vanity parenting part of that comes in at the point at which parents, on some level, decide that they are going to link their own feelings about themselves to how well the child does. And at that point, what happens now is that they are essentially drawing a measure of self-esteem from the kid's performance, and the kid knows that. So when the parent says, "I'm proud of you," what that means for the kid is that essentially you are depending upon me to cause you to feel good about yourself, so that now I know that my performance is linked to your well-being, and now I've got to keep my performance up in order to cause you to feel okay. And it's at that point, I think, that that parents can start kind of getting enmeshed around the issue of performance with their kids. And they lose sight of the fact that the performance is for the kid, it's not for the parent. And then part of the thing that makes this most difficult is we're also a very competitive society, and to some degree I think parents can get into a kind of competition with each other. I mean, that's that extraordinary question. You know, how is your child doing? That's the performance question. And how is your child doing? You know, and that means essentially it's kind of a veiled question to the parent. Well, then how are you doing as a parent? And it's a trap question. So parents want to be able to say around their kids' performance, not I'm proud of you, but good for you, and put the credit where it belongs.
I'm in a lot of trouble here.
In the vanity dimension of that. I mean, in the worst case, what happens is parents literally, it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen some, where parents, you know, get so invested in the performance of their child that it becomes, in fact, you know, essentially a mainstream support of their own personal well-being. And then that can, I think, become destructive.
Well, we're getting a whole bunch of uh-ohs, and my heart's pounding. So let's just clarify this, because, you know, I'm always telling my girls, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm so proud of you. I know that was tough, or, you know, I'm really proud of you. You know, you're doing so great. I mean, even my 25-year-old, I still tell her I'm proud of you. So, I mean, I never looked at it that way. I just was really just proud of them, that, you know, for their accomplishments. So, how do you let them know that you appreciate their accomplishments without letting them know that you're proud of them?
I think the two dangerous parenting statements that you can make to kids, one is I'm proud of you, and the other is I'm disappointed in you. When you tell a kid that you're disappointed in them, what that means is, at least what I've seen in counseling, is that the kid has lost loving standing in the parent's eyes.
Right.
You know, that's not a good statement to make. I think the better statement to I'm proud of you is good for you. I'm so happy for you.
Is everyone writing this down? Okay, now we've got it.
That's a far less entangling.
And you know, that's so true, though, because I can remember growing up, you know, I had wonderful parents, and, you know, I was never, you know, spanked or anything like that. And I can just remember getting that look and feeling like I disappointed. And, you know, I can remember my heart just sunk. And that was it. There didn't need to be words. There didn't need to be punishment. Just knowing.
Right. Now, I've had kids, adolescent kids, tear up in counseling with parents in response to that statement. You have really let us down. You have really disappointed us.
So yeah, I mean, words really do hurt. But, you know, for the parents that, you know, that are concerned about, that, you know, the behavior and the achievements of their children is a reflection on them, they should have a couple of kids. Because, you know, none of them are alike. So either, you know, if they're all a mess, then you know what? It may be the parenting. But I think more than likely you're going to find that some do well and some struggle. You know, they're all different.
Well, yeah, the issue is, it goes back to the earlier thing. I think that our job is just to help understand how our kids are wired, help understand, you know, the psychological hand they've been dealt, then help our kids understand that and learn to manage that. So it isn't a question of, you know, which child is doing better than another. It's exactly what you say. Every child is different.
Right. It's more self-work.
Is teaching our, you know, helping our kid learn to manage the hand that they've been dealt to, the, you know, so that it works for them. And that's really all that's involved. And
that's a great skill for children to learn.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The next article that I wanted to go move on to was one that was near and dear to my heart, which was developmental delay and a compressed adolescence.
Oh, yeah.
And I did not take from this that it was a developmental delay as in a developmental disorder.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify that. It's not about a developmental disorder. And to quote from it, you say, the longer the adolescence is delayed, the more intense it is likely to be.
Right.
And, you know, I know a lot of parents want to ward off those teen years and keep their babies a baby. So, you know, why is this a bad idea?
It's not a good idea. I think, generally speaking, you know, most adolescence kicks in around 9 to 13. But some kids who are strongly attached or don't want to separate, a lot of times only children adolesce late. What happens is the opening of adolescence may not occur until high school. And then what happens is that you get the stages of adolescence become compressed. That is, they unfold very quickly. So you get the negative attitude and the active and passive resistance and the testing of limits, which is early adolescence. And just as that's starting, then what happens is you start getting the increased intensity, particularly around more conflict that comes with mid adolescence, and then right on the heels of that, you get the acting grown-up activities that happen with late adolescence, and it all unfolds in a period of about a year and a half to 2 years. And it is a very, very intense ride for the kid, and it's a very intense ride for the parents. It's, you know, it's not a bad thing. It just makes for some hard developmental growth for the kid and some hard parenting for the parents. And what it takes is parents really have to maintain a close communicative connection and a firm structure and a non-volatile response to this young person who is just going through an enormous amount of compressed change in a hurry.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that leads to the next article, which is fearful parenting. And, you know, I don't know that. I'm so glad I'm talking to you because, you know, I have only one child. But, you know, I do. I mean, I've been down this road several times, and I have to do it two more times. But, you know, in fearful parenting, you know, you say what's commonly heard is parenting is much more scary than it was, you know, for our parents when we were growing up. Which you disagree with. I don't know if I disagree, but then again, I have teenage girls.
Right.
How do we balance the fear with safety?
Well, fear is just an emotion. I mean, emotions are, you know, emotions are very, very good informants, and they're very bad advisors. So that what the fear does, the fear warns us of danger, just like anger tells us about violations and frustration tells us about blockages. So, I mean, emotions are part of our awareness system. We need them. But what you don't want is you don't want to think with your feelings, because when you think with your feelings, what happens is the advice that fear gives us very often is to overreact to a situation and make a bad, hard situation worse. So the question with fear is, what is the possible danger that fear is warning us about, and then how realistic is it? And if it is realistic, you know, is there something that we need to, you know, by way of preparation, we need to help our kid with? You know, if it's relatively unlikely, is it something that we have to, you know, spend a lot of our energy on? And, you know, what we're dealing with, I think, with fearful parenting is that what is different in our age, as opposed to our parents' and our grandparents' age, is that we are under constant multimedia attack around, you know, all kinds of scary things that are happening in the world, and particularly scary things that are happening to children, and sensation sells. And so what you have is the old editorial, you know, guideline for the front page: if it bleeds, it leads. And so what happens is, through all these media, you know, all these sensational stories, there's an onslaught that's very scary for parents. And parents, you know, really need to slow themselves down, to ask themselves, you know, yes, this is a horrible thing that did happen, but what is the likelihood of it happening to our child? If it seems relatively likely, then what are some reasonable precautions that we can take? And I think, you know, you want to be able to think with your head. You don't want to allow fear to take over, because it's the same thing. And you want to model that for your kid. You don't want the kid, you know, seeing a frightened parent, you know, getting all upset and hysterical about something,
right,
and becoming non-rational. You know, because then what happens is the kid, you know, from that learns that, boy, if you get scared, you know, you just let fear take over. And so now you get the kid who's, I think I cited in that blog, you know, the kid who gets scared, he looks like he's going to be stopped by the police, and so he starts running away because he's scared, and now he just doubled up his offense, and he's created a dangerous pursuit for himself. So the issue with fear is to slow yourself down and then ask yourself, and particularly teach your kids to ask themselves, when I think about it, you know, if I were not feeling afraid, what would I choose to do in this situation? And then use that advice, not the advice that fear gives you.
Yeah, because, you know, I find even in my parenting, you know, I don't even let my daughters walk home from the bus stop. And I say, you know, sometimes I say to myself, oh, I'm going to make them such, you know, so anxious. But then, you know, you do have that fear that, you know, I don't want a teenage girl walking alone, you know, through a development, you know. So it's always difficult.
What you're doing is you are saying that, you know, based upon my judgment about the possibility of harm, you know, there is a measure of safety that is worthwhile making in terms of, you know, being there to walk my child home.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's a judgment, and it's a, you know, that's a fine judgment to make. The only thing is, what happens is, it's like, I mean, if the problem, and I try to mention it in that article, it's the problem of protection. Every time that we teach precaution and we teach protection, we also enliven the sense of fear and danger. So that, I mean, that's why when we go through the security in the airport, you know, we know that's for security, but it is a firm reminder that we are under terrorist threat.
Right, and necessity. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's, I mean, these are complicated judgments. I think probably the most common thing that the outcome of fearful parenting is high controlling parenting, and the kid sees it as my parents just overprotective. But really, what's happening is the parent is frightened of harmful things possibly happening to their child, and so they are, you know, they're staking out a whole variety of controls in the kid's life to. You know,
right.
You
know, yeah, I mean, I think there could be extremes to anything. You know,
yeah.
Any extreme is no good.
Yeah, but it's, I think it's very hard. I mean, and it's the same thing. It's very hard in our culture not to be getting into some vanity parenting with our kids, and it's very hard for us not to get into some fearful parenting of our kids. And those are culturally induced, I believe.
Right. And you know, as if these kids don't have enough to deal with.
Right.
The last time you were on, we focused on your book, Why Good Kids Act Cruel. And, you know, I just love that book, and I really encourage people to read it, because it really explains the psychology behind bullying and social cruelty, which is, I think, so important for people to understand from the perspective of the victim
the
bully.
These are not bad kids, you know, that are doing these things. I mean, these are developmentally insecure kids who are just trying to take care of themselves, you know, in early adolescence, you know.
Right, and you target the early adolescent years in that book.
Right.
And, you know, I think that it can even start as young as kindergarten, but you target those early adolescent years. So,
well, it can start, the behaviors can start earlier. But the vulnerability opens up in early adolescence. That's why I targeted early adolescence, because all of a sudden, you know, with a young child, that child is not focusing on independence.
Right.
The early adolescent is focusing on independence, and now they're out there in an independent world of peers. And so when those socially cruel behaviors happen, they are much more powerful than they were in childhood. But certainly, sure, kids can tease and bully and exclude and all, you know, all the other stuff in childhood as well.
Right, and I think, you know, that people don't understand that sometimes, that, you know, there are a lot of components to bullying that isn't just, you know, pushing or shoving or, you know, words.
Right.
I mean, there's, you know, excluding. But actually tomorrow night I'm going to be doing a special on bullying. I have Judge Alex Ferrer coming on, and, you know, he'll be discussing bullying, and he had an anti-bullying campaign where he did a two-part special on his court TV show. He's a wonderful man. He's making a difference for these kids. Judge Alex Ferrer, he has a court TV. One question I did want to ask you was, you know, you wrote that when adults ignore acts of social cruelty, they become more complicit in the problem.
Right.
So can you just explain how a parent can actually become a participant in what the child is doing if the child is bullying.
Well, when, I mean, so, well, the years ago I was at a working with a parent group at a PTA on social cruelty, and what happened was the one parent got up and essentially said to another parent, "Your child has been bullying my child." At which point the accused parent, got extremely protective and defensive of their kid and said, "Well, your kid just doesn't know how to stand up for themselves." And, you know, what happens is that the message, it's, you know, parents don't want to have received the message that their kid is engaging in socially cruel behaviors. That's why if parents are going, you know, if one parent is going to speak to another parent about it, they need to be, very non-evaluative and very specific, and in no way attack the child or the parent, but just talk about the concern for both kids in the relationship and how.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's it. There has to be concern for the bully as well. I mean, you have to, the only way to resolve the problem is to resolve the issue that the bully is having also,
Well, also, I mean, the other part of it is that, again, now is later, and,
right.
That, the kid who learns that it is okay to bully now can become coercive in relationships later on. And so being allowed, bully, having parents kind of look the other way,
right,
doesn't serve the bully very well.
And, the days of kids will be kids is over. There are just too many suicides and too many tragedies happening, and, kids will not be kids. Kids have to learn how to be, kind. But, due to time, I have two other articles I wanted to talk about, but I'm going to move ahead because Boomerang, this is a book I don't want to have to read. When I saw it, I said, I really hope I don't need this information. I want to read a little bit from the introduction because I think this is something that, I have friends that have kids that are coming back home, and it is so common. So I just want to read a little bit from the introduction, and then we're going to go into it. Most parents are ignorant of the complex challenges that trial independence brings. They like to believe that graduation from high school signifies that their young person is now ready to act responsibly, grown up. In fact, for most young people, it takes the 3 to 5 years after high school when the adolescent is living away from home, struggling to operate more on his own, to actually master the skills for independent living. Most adults and most young people themselves vastly underestimate the complexity of this.
Yeah,
well,
that's the last stage of adolescence is I think the hardest one, and it's trial independence, 18 to 23. When kids are stepping out on their own and all of a sudden they realize that they are, not fully equipped to handle all the commitments and responsibilities and demands of what it takes to be an independent person. And these kids are, they're surrounded by a cohort of other kids the same age who are slipping and sliding and breaking commitments and all of a sudden, making bad mistakes, and there's a self-esteem drop because now they wonder, gosh, I'm 20 years old and I can't get my life together, and they get down on themselves, and it's, maximum alcohol and drug use, and it's a kind of a crazy time that kids have to, go through. And most kids, while on the one hand they're spreading their wings, they also have to keep their footing, and most kids have a hard time keeping their footing all the time, and that's why you get somewhere between, I don't know what the figures I've seen are, is somewhere between 30% or 40% of kids in trial independence return home for some period of time, essentially to recover, regroup, and then gather the energy to re-enter again. And that's the reason I wrote the book was, it's social cruelty was really about early adolescence, the first stage. This Boomerang Kids is about the last stage. And I wanted...
But I think that, from what I saw, I want to thank you. You sent me the first 3 chapters. The book isn't released yet. I really saw how they really are connected, all of these different stages. And, think, before I even say that, I think that it's important that, children need a safety net from the time they're very young up until, you know, maybe 25 years old. I mean, maybe forever. My mother says you never stop worrying.
Well, we're always parents, but I think,
right.
I mean, that's right. Sometimes parents think if I can just get them out of high school, my parenting is mostly over. And what I try to tell parents is, no, your kid is entering the hardest phase of adolescence.
Right.
And you need to be present and connected with your kid more than ever, but you have to switch your parenting role. And depending upon the parents, they can have an easier or a harder time with that, because they have to go from being essentially a managerial parent during the first three stages of adolescence, from the late elementary school up through high school, where they set limits and made demands and imposed a structure and, you know, and expected accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And now what happens is, you know, if they hold to that managerial role when the kid leaves their care, when that kid makes a misstep or gets in difficulty, they're not likely to come back to parents for help about how to deal with the situation. That's why parents need to, when the kid graduates high school, the parents need to shift from managing to mentoring. And what they do then is they move from what is essentially a vertical relationship with their kid, which is essentially an authority relationship, to a more horizontal relationship, which is much more of a collaborative one, where essentially what they're saying is, you know, should you get into any kind of difficulty, you know, we are here, and you can come and talk to us without fear of anger or disappointment or criticism or anything like that. And, you know, and lay out the situation, and we will give you the benefit of our experience in terms of how, you know, you may choose your way out of whatever situation you've chosen your way into.
And that really goes back to all of the things that we've discussed as I'm listening to you say that, because, you know, that goes back to really delaying development. It goes back to... You know, it just goes back to all of it. It goes back to, you know, preparing them very young. And, you know, I think most importantly, it really goes back to building that relationship with your kids, because you can't start to develop that type of relationship at 18.
That's right. If you have the parents that I see have the hardest time making that shift are high authoritarian parents who know what's best, who know what's right, you know, and who are, you know, prepared to, you know, jump in should their kid, you know, in their judgment, get in difficulty or misbehave. And what happens is that parent in that position is not a parent that kid will come and talk to. And that's really sad.
Right.
Because what kids need at this point is, it needs to be a mutual respect relationship where the parent essentially says, I respect your adolescent right to make your own decisions and take responsibility for dealing with them. And the adolescent says, and I respect your wisdom from more life experience that I can draw on when I need it.
Oh, there's nothing better than when you get that call from your, you know, 20-something-year-old and, you know, they're asking you advice and, you know, they're talking to you about things. You know, it's a great thing. I do want to, you know, we have 10 minutes left and I don't want to eliminate these things. I want to go into some of the crises that you write about that are very common. So let's start and just briefly go through them. The first one is missing home and family. So when your kid goes off to college.
Well, what happens is that a lot of kids, you know, they don't even think about missing home and family when they leave. But then they get old, say they go to college, and all of a sudden, you know, they don't have that close structure around them. They don't have those people who care about them around them. You know, all of a sudden they feel like, you know, they are lacking a kind of a support and communication that they never really valued until they left it behind, and they haven't yet developed their own independent social world in as nurturing a way. And so, you know, what happens is that, You know, some kids just get, you know, they get so lonely that one of the crises that can happen is, I mean, you can get kids who just literally get homesick, where they, you know, they say, you know, I'm just not ready to leave home yet, and they come home for that cause, because they want to, you know, they want to be able to have have more of that connection in their
right.
life. And more
and
of that
sometimes they're just not ready. They need, yeah, they need that nurturing still, you know.
Now, I was talking, very interesting, I was talking with a reporter in Santiago, Chile, and we were talking about this. She said, well, she says, in our country, you know, our kids don't leave home until they're about 25.
Right.
Which was very, you know, very interesting. So
there
know,
are a lot of cultures, yes, that the,
yeah,
the children stay with them.
We,
yeah.
We have this expectation somehow you're 18 and you're out.
Yeah, you're grown.
And,
you
know,
it's
you
know, crazy.
There's no firm timeline on departure.
That's really when you need to be closest connected because, you know, that's when, you know, they're out on their own and that's when, you know, they can really be devastated by the reality of what the real world is like. And you
exactly.
mentioned also... roommate problems and love relationships. I mean, these, you know, are devastating for you know, boys and girls in their 20s.
Well, yeah, because most of these kids have never had a, you know, this is their first experience with a quasi, you know, domestic partnership. And they don't know how to deal with incompatible differences on a daily basis, you know. They don't know how to share and cooperate on a daily basis. They don't know how to manage disagreement on a daily basis. They don't know how to speak up about what bothers them on a, you know, with a ongoing relationship on a daily basis. And so, you know, a lot of these kids, you know, the roommate challenge and some of these situations are extremely challenging. You know, suppose you get a child who's a, you know, is kind of a settled, quiet person, and they get, you know, they all of a sudden they find themselves rooming with somebody who's got freedom for the first time, and it's just, you know, going all out,
gone wild,
all of a sudden,
right?
You know,
right.
You get this quiet kid, you know, having this wild ride through college because of the roommate activity. So there are all kinds of you know, difficult skills that kids have to learn.
I think it's important too for parents to start constructing a niche for these kids because, you know, not all kids can go off to a university and live in a dorm. There are some kids, especially those that maybe, you know, have Asperger's, be mild on the spectrum, that are just not going to be able to handle it. You know, there are some kids that, you know, may be better off living off campus with, you know, a selected roommate in a small apartment in a quieter setting. So I think the parents also have to do their homework before they pack the bags, too, you know. And,
well,
you know, another thing...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, there's no command that says that, you know, when you are 18, you, number one is you have to leave home. There's
right.
no command that says when you leave home, you're on your own and we won't be communicating with you. There's no command that says that, you know, you leave home and you make all your own arrangements and we won't be involved in that. I mean, there are all kinds of choice points here. I mean, usually the missing home and family, the kids that get, you know, that have it in a serious degree, what they need, at least for the first year, is that they need, you know, adequate communication by parents, letting the kid know that that kid is in their mind and hearts, and they, you know, and then what happens is the kid gradually develops their own independent social world away, you know, then all of a sudden, you know, they adjust to the separation, and that's really what's going on. It's a separation anxiety on the one hand, and on the other hand, and that's one of the things I mentioned in there around the missing home and family, there are some kids who had a peak experience in high school. And,
right.
You know, they were really important there. They had lots of friends. They did extremely well. And all of a sudden, you know, I had this young man say to me, you know, here at University of Texas, he said, you know, back home I was somebody. Here I'm nobody.
Oh, right.
And, you know, and they really missed that. And they
yeah, and, you know, it's
old,
funny. The other day I was driving in the car with my daughter, and my other daughter was talking about this other person, and, you know, they're just, you know, the star sports and, you know, the best singer and the best this. My 17 turns around and she goes, that's okay. I'd rather not peak in high school.
Well, right, exactly.
It's just like that's a great attitude.
yeah, because what happened, because all of a sudden that's when you leave. I mean, that's one of the... You know, one of the impacts is all of a sudden you realize that the world is much larger and more
right.
complicated than you ever thought. And I mean, part of the reason I wrote the book was we know that kids come home, but what I wanted to get at was why do kids come home? And that's why I write about 11 different causes for kids
right.
coming home. Of course, there are multiple causes when a kid comes home. But if parents can understand what these are, then it seems to me there are some supportive things parents can do around these issues when the kid comes home, and there are supportive things that they can do in advance to prevent their kid from having to come home. So it's kind of letting the kid know parents to get ready to help their kid during this last stage.
Right, and I think that, you know, letting kids think that coming home is the end of the world isn't such a great thing either, you know. The door's always open, and, you know, you give it a try. If that didn't work for you, the next thing will. I know that one thing I do want to go into before we start wrapping up is indebtedness, because I know, you know, as soon as your kid graduates, your mailbox is going to be filled.
Absolutely.
With credit card applications yeah. for these kids. And it's very tempting. But when you have a child that's living away from home, they need a credit card. They need to have financial security, some safety. But, you know, parents can be very smart about, you know, having limitations or whatever. So what is your feeling on it? Because I know with my older kids, you know, I just really felt that it was a teaching tool for them. And that, you know, they also wanted them to build up credit so that when they wanted to get apartments or whatever, you know, they'd have that option. So what is your feeling?
Well, I think that the kids need training in managing themselves financially, and that training of managing and financially in terms of, you know, of banking, in terms of budgeting, in terms of borrowing, you know, that kind of thing needs to start in high school, so that when the kid exits high school, they have the smallest next step to independence. And in this sense, in the financial sense, they have been managing, you know, a certain amount of their own financial affairs while they have been living at home. Sometimes, you know, that means parents can talk about, you know, managing, you know, how they manage a credit card. Sometimes parents, will the kid use one of their credit cards, but what they will also do is, you know, when the bill comes in, you know, they will go over that with the kid, and the kid will have the responsibility, you know, for paying whatever those charges are.
Right. Right. But I think, you know, it all leads to giving, you know, really teaching them independence. And, you know, that's really the ultimate goal. I mean, that's what your job is as a parent. It's, you know, it's all the stages, and it's really to bring them to a point of independence. But, you know, what I have, like I said, the book isn't out. I haven't read it, but I understand that each chapter ends with a parenting prescription. So if you could just, in 1 minute, give us an idea of what that is and let us know when the book is coming out.
The book will be out in August. Put out by Source Books. It's called Boomerang Kids, and it's revealing why so many of our children are failing on their own and how parents can help. And, for example, around issues of stress, which is one of the causes for kids coming home, one of the parenting prescription has to do with teaching kids how to manage demand in their life, particularly over-demand, and putting, you know, taking control of the goals and standards and limits they set in their life. It also has to do with the besetting sin of many of these kids that they carry into this stage that creates a lot of stress, which is the management of procrastination and helping our kids, you know, break that habit, because procrastination creates an enormous amount of stress in the lives of these kids. And it also has to, the other prescription has to do with providing themselves with adequate self-maintenance. And among the highest priority there is these kids getting enough sleep, because most of these kids are sleep deprived to their cost.
Right. We're about to run out of time, so I did want to thank you so much for joining us. I welcome you back anytime. You're just a treasure trove.
Lovely talking with you. I really enjoy it.
And I did want to mention a website. There's a website, and you can follow them on Twitter. And Talking Teenage is just fantastic. I mean, it is written by two psychologists, and it's almost like it's a foreign language, and they just translate for us. So anybody that has a teen, you should check that out. Also, Dr. Picard's books and his writings on Psychology Today, outstanding. Tomorrow, I have Judge Alex Ferrer and Judge Glenda Hatchett will be joining me for a special edition. And we have our chats going on Monday morning, Tuesday morning, and Thursday morning. They are fantastic. We have great topics for you this week. And as I end the show every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us tonight on The Coffee Clutch.
Wow.